Hi, everyone. Thank you very much. Thank you to Reverend Kilmer for inviting me to be here. I am a lawyer at CCR, at the Center for Constitutional Rights. I was asked specifically to address the sort of discrete aspect of the targeting of U.S. citizens. CCR and the ACLU brought litigation challenging the drone killings of three U.S. citizens in 2011. So I was sort of going to describe that litigation and talk to you about the state of legal accountability in the United States, which is pretty bleak. But just for context, in terms of just casualties and impact, U.S. citizens represent less than a fraction of people killed and injured as part of the U.S. drone program outside of Afghanistan since 2002. If you look at the numbers of a group called the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, which has documented exhaustively killings over the past decade, there have been as many as 5,600 deaths in Yemen, Pakistan, and Somalia alone since 2002. To our knowledge, four of them have been American citizens. They were Anwar al-Awlaki and Samir Khan, who were killed in drone strikes in September 2011 in Yemen. 2 weeks later, Anwar al-Awlaki's 16-year-old son, Abdul Rahman al-Awlaki, who was killed in October of 2011. Another American, whose name is Jude Keenan Mohammed, who's gotten far less attention, who was killed in November of 2011 in Pakistan. And then early last year, we heard media reports of a fifth American who had been authorized for killing in Pakistan. So really a minuscule sort of impact in terms of impact. We don't have a good picture, as has been said earlier today, a good picture of the human costs or impact on the side of drone operators, and I think that's significant in terms of psychological impact. But the fact that most of the human costs on the drone end, on the other drone end, are remote from the standpoint of the majority of Americans, not only in terms of location, but in terms of identity, and this has been talked about today, is I think one of the challenges we face in making the US public care about what we are doing in other countries. To the extent the public is concerned, they care more, not surprisingly, when the impact hits closer to home. So it was telling, as Marjorie was just talking about, that the greatest moment of public debate we have had in this country about this program was when the white paper, the Justice Department white paper, discussing the authority, the legal authority to kill American citizens was leaked in early 2013. By that point, by February of 2013, there were as many as 4,000 people who had already been killed. And that is when we as a country sort of began talking more publicly about this program. It was after that leak, after Rand Paul's famous 13-hour filibuster railing against the president's claimed authority to kill Americans, that support for drone strikes dropped to their lowest point yet. So at that point, if you look at Gallup polls, with all the caveats about polls, but the majority of Americans, 52% at that time, said they opposed drone strikes against U.S. citizens abroad, so a majority. And opposition reached 79% when the question was about the possibility of strikes against Americans on U.S. soil. The only circumstance under which those polled supported drone strikes was when they were used against foreign citizens on foreign soil. Under that scenario, 65% were in favor and 28% opposed. Clearly, we tolerate torture and inhumanity right here. If you look, there are many examples we could talk about. If you look at one other issue I work on, solitary confinement in U.S. prisons, the majority of the public still believes that prolonged isolation of people, 22 to 24 hours a day, for decades, is an acceptable form of punishment, despite that under the law, that is torture. That's recognized as torture. But I do think that distance, geographically, culturally, religiously, and in terms of national identity, are in the mix of factors, along with fear, fatigue, and then, of course, secrecy, that we have to bridge in reaching people and making them care and pay attention. I think transparency, and this is something I've come to feeling sort of over the past decade of working on torture and detention, I think transparency and more information is essential, but I don't think that is the main obstacle, actually. I think we know quite a bit. There is a difference in having government information But we do know quite a bit about this program and the impact over the past 10 years. So I don't think it's just a lack of information that is keeping the public at large, I think, from taking action. So just given the sort of very disparate impact of this program in terms of US citizens, foreign citizens at CCR, we faced a certain moral question when the authorization for the targeting of Anwar al-Awlaki, an American citizen in Yemen, was leaked to the press in 2010, which was, in a world of our limited resources, do we pursue a legal case on behalf of the family of that individual, or do we go forward with the legal challenges we've been thinking about on behalf of Pakistani civilians who were dying in huge numbers at that time and who continue to be bearing the brunt? In our view, the legal violations were equally clear. So under international law, the United States is bound to respect constraints on the use of lethal force irrespective of citizenship. That if you look at the text of the Due Process Clause of the Fifth Amendment in the Constitution, it applies to persons, not exclusively citizens, and there is Supreme Court precedent for the extension of those protections abroad to the conduct of U.S. actors operating abroad outside of the mainland of the United States. But the difference was that when it comes to enforcing those rights, citizenship has been a plus factor. It is not dispositive by any means. There have been cases brought by U.S. citizens in other contexts that have been dismissed the same way that foreign citizen cases have been dismissed. There have been groundbreaking victories on behalf of foreign citizens despite non-U.S. citizenship, but citizenship can matter. So when we were sort of, just in terms of it's been a plus factor in terms of jurisdiction, and jurisdiction, which is basically the opportunity to be heard, simply to be heard in court, has been the challenge in national security cases over the past decade in the context of torture, detention, killing, rendition. There have been over a dozen cases brought, and in every single case, virtually every single case, the government's knee-jerk response has been to dismiss on various arguments relating to the risk to national security, the need for secrecy, executive supremacy. So our calculus at the end of the day, and it was a very difficult decision, was that given the greater, the possibly greater chance that our clients could actually be heard and have a day in court, regardless of the outcome, that we would pursue the case, the al-Awlaki litigation, and we did that with the ACLU. We ultimately brought two cases. So there was one challenging the authorization for the killing of Anwar al-Awlaki before the fact. That was in 2010. And then there was a second case that we brought after a drone strike killed him in a car in Yemen, along with another US citizen, Samir Khan, who I mentioned, killing both of them. And the government has said only about Samir Khan. It's gone on for pages and pages about its accusations against Anwar al-Awlaki and some very serious ones about Samir Khan, who also died. It has said only that he was not specifically targeted. That strike killed two Yemeni citizens as well, who we don't talk that much about. And then 2 weeks later, 16-year-old Abdul Rahman, Anwar al-Awlaki's son, was killed as he was having a meal outside in plain view with his teenage cousin, a 17-year-old, having dinner when a missile fired on them, killing them and at least six other people. About him, the United States has also only said that he was not specifically targeted. It has said nothing else about that 16-year-old boy's death, who was born in Denver, Colorado. So our second case was challenging, after the fact, the legality of all three of those killings on behalf of their families. Our legal theories in those cases were pretty similar, and they were not radical, despite the controversy that the litigation generated. It was not that the United States could not use lethal force under constitutional and international law, but it was simply that any use of force had to respect the law. And we said that the general rule under constitutional and international human rights law is that states are prohibited from killing without due process, except in the face of an imminent threat, where imminence incorporates a requirement of specificity. There has to be a specific and imminent threat, and lethal force is a last resort in the face of that threat. The only exception to that universal general rule is in battlefield circumstances, where the exigency of the conditions permits a certain loosening of the rules, though still not without constraints. So in 2009 and 10 and 11, when Anwar al-Awlaki was being targeted and then killed, we said that there was no battlefield in Yemen involving the United States. And even accepting the US's global war paradigm, that it was involved in a global war against al-Qaeda, that al-Awlaki was the specific group, you had to sort of be specific and look at the specific allegations, and Anwar al-Awlaki was alleged to be part of a group that was said to be associated with al-Qaeda, not al-Qaeda proper. And while that group may have shared at that time anyway, a certain ideology with al-Qaeda, there were not the sort of structural links that were required to make it an associated force. So under those two theories, we said his targeting would fall outside of an armed conflict war type situation that might justify his killing, that the law that should apply are the general rules where lethal force has to be after due process or in the face of an imminent threat as a last resort, and that his killing was unlawful, or that if it was carried out, it would be unlawful. In that first case, we also included a claim about his right to notice under the Fifth Amendment, under due process, that he had a right to notice of the criteria that could make him subject to killing. And as we know, the criteria and the legal standards for targeting of US citizens and foreign citizens remain opaque. We have a white paper, we have a heavily redacted legal memo from the Justice Department, and we have a crib sheet of policy standards. That is what we have after a decade. The government's responses were also similar to both cases. They moved to dismiss both. The Obama administration's stated position is that it believes judicial review of any targeted killing operation is inappropriate. It has stated that publicly, and it exercised that position in court. In the public realm and in their internal memos, the government acknowledges that US citizens retain their due process rights abroad. So in his speech at the National Defense University in May of 2013, President Obama said that he didn't believe it would be constitutional for the government to target and kill any US citizen with a drone or a shotgun, he said, without due process. So there is recognition that we retain our rights abroad as well as here. It's just that due process doesn't mean judicial process as far as the government is concerned. So when it comes to killing people outside of recognized or traditional battlefields, due process does not, in the government's mind, require charge and trial necessarily. So that's sort of its stated position publicly in court, in its papers in court. The government did indeed argue that even accepting that Anwar al-Awlaki, Samir Khan, and Abdulrahman retain their Fifth Amendment rights, and that there might have been a violation, that it would be inappropriate for the court to actually review their claims because of national security considerations. The court unfortunately also responded similarly to both of our cases in accepting the government's arguments and dismissing those cases. In the first case, the court said, held that the question of whether carrying out the standing order to kill Anwar al-Awlaki would violate his constitutional rights, his Fifth Amendment due process rights, was a political question, not a court decision. It was a political question reserved for the executive and Congress, even while the district court judge acknowledged that that ruling was unprecedented to say, just as a sort of a matter of common sense, to say that a constitutional claim alleging by a US citizen the violation of his due process rights for his killing by his government was a question reserved to the executive. Recognized that that was an unprecedented ruling, but went ahead and dismissed the case. In the second case, the court sort of interestingly rejected that broadest of the government's claims and said that no, there is nothing inherently inappropriate about a court exercising judicial review of constitutional claims by US citizens against their own government, but that it would exercise its discretion in deciding that it shouldn't have a role. So she found the district court in our second case, which was after the fact of these killings, said that there may have indeed been a violation of Anwar al-Awlaki's due process rights, but that she wouldn't decide whether there had been a violation and whether he was entitled to a remedy because of national security factors. And with respect to Samir Khan and Abdulrahman, she simply found that they had not demonstrated a violation at all because they hadn't been intentionally targeted, despite the fact that drones deliberately, intentionally fired on their heads. So she said there had just been no plausible stated Fifth Amendment violation at all. So in the end, after years of subjecting themselves to scrutiny and reliving their grief, our clients decided not to pursue an appeal. And the cases ended there at the district court level. So it is, accountability has been very challenging in all national security contexts, not just in the targeted killing context, but it is important to be clear that it remains an open question in this context, because the only litigation that has been brought has only gone as so far as the district court level. And there is quite strong Supreme Court precedent for the unconstitutionality of what the government is doing. It's just that cases haven't gone that far, and then Supreme Court review is discretionary. You don't have a right to go to the Supreme Court, so whether cases actually even go that far remains a question. So at this point, legal accountability with respect to this program remains elusive in the United States. Political accountability is at best checkered. Most members of Congress remain in the dark about the full scope of this program. Until 2 years ago, the committees that are tasked with oversight hadn't seen the full legal memos discussing the killings of US citizens. And then there is no meaningful public accountability, because to this date, the government continues to hold back its own data about how many people have been killed, who they are, where it has happened, the legal standards, even basic acknowledgement. So the four US citizens I talked about at the beginning, there have been half a dozen cases that the United States has acknowledged publicly, officially. Four of them are of US citizens. And meanwhile, these drone strikes continue. I think there's a real, in terms of the law and the landscape, a reassessment we sort of need to make at this point in light of a shift of operations in Iraq and Syria and changed facts on the ground in Yemen. But there are still real legal problems with this program, and drone strikes continue. And this month alone, over the past 3 weeks alone, 31 people died in Pakistan. And all we know is that they were militants, according to press reports. Just a quick word about other accountability with respect to civilian casualties. Just as a starting point, accountability separate from judicial and legal accountability would mean just disclosing basic information in situations where credible, plausible allegations of civilian harm have been presented. The United States has an obligation under international law to investigate and then to publicly explain in a meaningful way the results of its investigation. That has not happened. To take one case in point, there was a US drone strike in Yemen in December of 2013 on a wedding party that killed 27 members of that party traveling in a wedding procession. Officials acknowledge, and that's a strike that has been documented by Human Rights Watch and other journalists and advocates. In response to allegations of civilian deaths, the government acknowledged the strike. It acknowledged that it said it was investigating, but it has to date failed on the record to say anything about the results of its investigation and has denied, in fact, officially that there were civilian deaths. In this void of even that basic kind of accountability, fortunately, international mechanisms have started filling the void. It's not enough. The United States bears the primary responsibility for accountability, but there are international groups and UN mechanisms that are stepping forward to fill the void. So for example, the Special Rapporteur on Counterterrorism, Ben Emmerson, started an inquiry in the beginning of 2013, investigating claims of civilian casualties and sort of spelling out the legal requirements under international law for the United States and other states to investigate at least and publicly disclose the results of their investigation. The European Parliament and the UN Human Rights Council have over the past year and a half, issued resolutions building on that duty of transparency and accountability. So there are positive steps in the international realm, but we're sorely lacking domestically. Thank you.